You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Buzz! Buzz! Buzz!
Welcome back to a special season preview edition of At the Buzzer, which is a Rocker Report podcast that talks about CU athletics. But today we don't care about the whole athletics ecosystem. We care about one sport, and that is men's basketball. I'm one half of the co-hosts, Jack. The other half over there is Sam. Welcome back from his extended European vacation. And then that doesn't matter because we have a special expert coming in. And that is, of course, the Rumbling Buff himself, Ben Burrows. Welcome back.
Hey, what's going on, guys? Happy to be back, and thank you for inviting me. This is going to be a really interesting season to talk about, and I'm just excited as hell to get going.
Yeah, so I've seen it's that time of year. You know, it's almost November when you start making the podcast rounds. Now that your big book of basketball is not coming out yearly, you are disseminating knowledge in other ways, which we greatly appreciate over here. So it's time to disseminate some knowledge before November 9th, I guess, which is Montana State. Am I right? State's the first game.
Yeah, Montana State.
Perfect. So this isn't completely random in terms of timing. We also just saw a nice exhibition game against a Power 5 opponent in Nebraska, if you can call them a Power 5 opponent. And CU walked away from that one, I think, with a 16-point loss. Mm-hmm. And before that, I think Ben and I both had a chance to take in the Mines exhibition in person. And Ben also had a chance, the one of three of us, to see the team in an open practice before a CU football game. So we're starting to see more of this team, some brand new faces, some slightly new faces, and, of course, fan favorite Evan Batty. Before we get into any specific findings from any of that, I just wanted a quick overview, Ben, of what you've seen from this team so far, or what you want to see, I guess.
Well, so far we haven't seen too much that I would take, try to extrapolate long term. You know, this is a developing team or a development program. This is a development year. As Ted has talked about multiple times, the team in November and December is going to be different, hopefully, from the team in January, February, and eventually March. They're going to be growing. They're going to be developing. So if you sat down on Saturday and watched a Nebraska game, it was a little ugly. And, you know, if you weren't really coming into the season prepared for that, you might be a little shocked. I would caution you from taking that too seriously. Mm-hmm. Certainly there is a lot to learn, a lot to develop, and a lot to, take to the practice table with those guys. And I'm sure Ted and the staff are doing that. But in terms mm-hmm. of how, you know, we should be approaching the season, I wouldn't take too much from these exhibitions. What we can take from them, however, is a good understanding of where the players are and kind of get a sense for where the rotation will be in a couple weeks, couple months. And I think we have some little stones that we can read, some little things that we can read in and amongst that.
Yeah, I do want to cross it. A lot of teams say they're young, and a lot of teams say they're young early to caution fans against, you know, some clunker performances. We've seen the football team use that excuse a little one too many times. This team is actually really, really young. I don't think Tad mentioned this, but someone pointed out that Nebraska exhibition, there was 6,000 fans in the stands. And that was the first time 10 players on CU's 12-man scholarship roster had played in front of fans, period, because of COVID.
Jesus.
Yeah, and that's on the road in a Power 5 environment. That's, you know, I guess it depends on how much you care about crowd noise and stuff. I think that would obviously affect you, especially as if it's your first college minutes, you're going to be excited. You're going to be nervous, all those things.
And if you want me to whine a little bit, I would also whine a little bit about how seriously maybe Nebraska took that. Like, they played their starters a little longer than maybe I would have expected. Hey, I'm not going to argue with it. You know, at the end of the day, it's an exhibition. However they want to use it, that's on them. Tad's using it for a very specific purpose. And I'm not saying that's why we lost or that's why we looked bad, because there was a lot of ugly, particularly early in that game.
You have to take the wins where when you can in Lincoln these days.
Right. The whole point of that scrimmage was to, as you noted, get those 10 players in front of a crowd before November 9th. And that box was checked, and that's really the only box I cared about.
Yeah. So let's just get into the Nebraska game. I think it's the one we might glean the most from before real play starts. I think CU went down in the first half. There was a 36-13 line, or maybe even a 39-13 line somewhere in there, where Nebraska was way up. And it looked, you know, from then on, it was pretty much in hand. I don't think there was anything. CU kind of got it close near the end. But you ended up with, I think it was an 82-68 score, 82-66 score. And there was not much resistance on the perimeter for Nebraska. They had a lot of shots go in. Some of them were really good shots. Some of them were shots that if the CU player took that shot, I would be flabbergasted. But they went in. And then the other side, we saw again that CU went, I think, what was it, 3-for-18 from the three-point line in that exhibition. So to me, the main thing that took away from that is, number one, shooting is going to be on and off all year this year. Just young team, a lot of shooters graduated, and road splits anyways are not that favorable. And then number two, I don't know. It might take this time some team – it'll take this team some time to gel defensively. I think those are two things that I took away from that.
Well, it also leads into my overall outlook for the season. You mentioned that shooting was kind of ugly in scrimmage. And again, we don't want to extrapolate too much from one game, but – last year, especially with the depth at the wing, with Dryhorn, with Sean Schwartz, et cetera, mm-hmm. you had a bunch of shooters. You had a team that could, in some games, and they did do this, just simply outshoot opponents. On a night when your defense is struggling or maybe other things aren't working, if you can cash those threes, you know, that helps. And they don't have that depth this season. There are guys who can shoot. You know, I have no problem with Keyshawn or even Tristan Jabari, you know, taking those outside jumpers, Elijah. But they're not the volume kind of shooters that we maybe had last year, the consistent volume kind of shooters. And you won't be able to just shoot yourself out of trouble this season as the Buffs. You're going to have to, as you noted, rely on defense. And especially with the young team, that's going to take a while to really develop, particularly to Tad's level of expectation on that end. And again, it kind of leads to the concept that you're going to be better in January than you were in December and November.
Yeah. Sam, well, I know you had a chance to see some of that game. What did you take away?
Yeah, I just think a lot of the young players, they're definitely figuring out where they need to be defensively. It seemed like they got a bit lost and confused in commotion and just lost track of their guys and were like late to contest. And there's a lot of times where you can see like Eli and Evan, who know where they're supposed to be, are like pointing at other guys to to be where they're supposed to be, because it will be a struggle. And but that's really to what Ben was saying.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to start with just overall some game flow impressions before I get too excited about a lot of the things I saw from that game, because I think that also will bleed over into full like season expectations. But you know, it was our first time seeing KJ Simpson against a real opponent that's not D2. It's our first time seeing Boston Lovering out there. You know, a lot of these guys that we will be seeing a lot of for a long time. And it was our first time seeing them in real game action. And thankfully, it didn't count against the win-loss column. But it's hard not to be excited about the future. If it's not this year, then the next multiple years with this recruiting class. And another thing I keep thinking about, too, is, man, it'd be nice when we shoot 3-for-18 from three to have Quincy Allen out there, who is out for the year. Would be nice to have him shoot some of those shots, because that guy is a sniper.
Yeah, and Tad made a very conscious decision not to to bring back either Horn or Deshaun. And I think part of the calculus that went into that decision was, well, yeah, I definitely want to get guys like Luke O'Brien and Nick Clifford and Tristan, you know, more minutes. But I think the other part of that calculation was, not only do I want to get them more minutes, but I've got depth at that position because Quincy's coming in. And then all of a sudden you don't have that. And I'm not saying he's going to regret his decision or it was a mistake. I don't believe that in either case. But you can certainly see an effect between Quincy not going to be there this year and some of the holes on the roster. And I can't help but think that had he known that Quincy wouldn't have been this year, that maybe he would have chosen a different path there. Regardless, we are where we are, and we're moving forward.
Yeah, I think the other thing I want to mention there, too, is genuinely, Tad Boyle's always, it's always been a player-led program, and I think that is, it's a really good thing that Schwartz will be able to star, or at least be the high-level starter at George Mason, and take more shots than he would have taken at CU, potentially. And the same with Dallas Walton at Wake Forest. You know, I think all these players went to places that allow them to showcase, kind of like, where did Trayshawn Fletcher go? His last year,
Toledo.
Yeah, and he averaged, what was it, like 18-10 or something? Like something that he
was a monster. He was like 21-10 or something like that.
And Mac Player of the Year.
Mac Player of the Year. Yeah.
Yeah. So something that he never would have had that volume, but with CU, and I'm glad that I think Deshaun will be able to showcase some more at George Mason, and you know, it's they're all going to be in better situations, and I think, you know, they will appreciate that, and that also trickles down. I mean, Tad's always trying to do right by those guys, and it helps, you know, when prospective recruits come in and they see that, you know, there's really no bad divorce there. But I don't know. It would have been nice to have someone like Horn back or Schwartz back just to take some of those shots, for sure.
Do we think that the starters against Nebraska are going to be the starters on day one?
Those being really quick, Keyshawn, Eli, Tristan Da Silva, Jabari Walker, Evan Batty, I believe is starting five.
Yeah. So that's like, none of those are unexpected except for Tristan to some. We've talked about that a lot about how Tad would lean. And it seems like they're going to go length and defense as much as they can to start games.
Well, I also don't know where else he could have gone with that. Quincy, without having retained either Jariah or Deshaun. I think the starting five is pretty much in stone. And I think it will be throughout the season, unless something weird happens or like Nick Clifford takes a huge leap. Although he's continued to really kind of impress throughout the preseason. Those starting five is pretty much in stone. And then I think that your next tier, you're like rotational three. I think we've got a pretty good solid idea of what 1 through 8 is going to look like. Mm-hmm. And then it's after that I'm kind of like, well, is it someone going to step up? For reference, my rotational pieces would look like KJ, some form of KJ, Lawson, or Neek. Who's first off the bench out of those three? Not really sure, but game to game, those three are going to be the first set off the bench. And then more of a fringe role player like Julian Hammond or Luke O'Brien, they're going to get game time. You know, believe me, they're going to get game time. We're going to go 10 deep, particularly because I think Luke's going to be needed on the wing from time to time. But those are pretty much set in stone, but particularly the starting five. Like I can't really see anything shaking that up from Taz's perspective right now, unless there is a big leap forward from someone like Neek.
Yeah, I was thinking, we were thinking at the beginning of the season, they might run like a two guards and then Eli would play the three. but it seems like they're probably not going to go with that, especially since they have less depth.
Yeah, yeah, especially if the guard depth isn't there. Yeah, I can see what you're saying. Okay, let's start KJ Simpson, but then you're a little short in the backcourt to start a game. You also lose that spark off the bench. I really look at KJ as someone who's going to bring in that energy every time he gets up off the bench, enters a game, both offensively but also defensively. It's going to be nothing but energy, and that's the kind of guy. Like, I kind of think back almost, and I don't want to compare the two because their games aren't identical. So don't go too far down this. But Ski Booker,
right?
Ski Booker's freshman year, he was spark plug off the bench, he was microwave off the bench, and I think ultimately that's the role that KJ will play, even though they're not necessarily directly comparable.
Yeah. I think it's going to be the easy comp for a lot of people too, in terms of just like profile, especially physically, both SoCal guards that came in. And I mean, I don't know if pugnacious is the right word, but they both are definitely not scared, you know, like they are going to like, just watching the Mines exhibition in person, it was fun to see. KJ is already so loud, like in general, just on the court, he's already so vocal, like saying, not necessarily all trash talk, but just like with his teammates, with the end, like, you know where he is at all times. And that's so fun to see, to be around, as long as it's not out of control. I don't think it's out of control at all, but
that was my first impression from even like the open scrimmage they had too. First play of the game, he rips for a breakaway layup dunk. Like, it, you know, and he wasn't like trash talking, but he was very vocal. He was very out there. Like, he plays with his personality. Some guys try to be reserved, you know, but kind of an Evan kind of thing. You play with your emotion, you play with your personality. And I think he's definitely that player.
Yeah, I guess that's a new duality choice we're going to give every CU recruit. Are you an Evan? Or are you an Eli? Everyone's either an Evan or an Eli.
Go ahead. Okay. Do you see any other like swing factors within the rotation, like something that you're looking for as the season goes along?
Obviously, key with any sort of TAD team is defense. Who's going to contribute defensively? You know, if a player is scoring but they can't defend, they're going to see their playing time evaporate. I think that more than anything is why, you know, Tristan's out there, is because he's a committed defender, that kind of thing. You know,
and he has a lot more like driving game than we thought that he showed.
He's a jack of all trades. He can do so many different things, but particularly defensively, that'll earn you playing time in TAD system. You know, there's another aspect of this, which is foul trouble. We talk about that a lot with like Jabari. Like, you know, how much can we really rely on this guy to be out there 25, 30 minutes a game if he's still fouling people at a 6-per-40 rate? I mean, that's Dustin Thomas levels. We can't have that. But realistically, defensively, we're going to have to rely on our defense, as I mentioned earlier. Who is going to step up defensively? Who wants a guard other than Elijah? If there's someone who can really commit to that, like, they're going to earn playing time. They're going to start to eat into playing time. I'm really looking at a guy like Neek. Like, can Neek be that defender? That's when you might see him start.
Especially just the Nebraska game, I actually really, really liked what he looked like in that game for Nick Clifford. I don't know if we want to like go through a full rotation yet, but I kind of expect him to be a sixth man or maybe come in as a package deal whenever KJ comes in. Because to me, it was so fun to see. He's a really good rebounder already at whatever he is, 6'6", 6'7". And he has the ability, because he played so much point in his life, to just take it, the board, the defensive rebound, and just go. And KJ is always trying to push the pace already. And so it's fun for me in Nebraska to do that a few times, where Clifford got the board and just went. KJ was already sprinting. They got to KJ at like half court, and then you have a 3-on-2 fast break or whatever. They didn't finish those as much as I'd like them to, but still, that's something that's really fun, that is useful that Clifford can bring, because he attacks the glass. He has been, even since the Costa Rica games this summer, has been attacking the glass, I think, pretty hard on both sides. And the fact that he can handle the ball out of that, at least for a little bit, is just such a nice thing to speed up the pace a little bit.
Yeah. And he's almost a throwback to the mid-decade version of TAD's program, where he was trying to get a bunch of 6'6", 6'7", tweeners and try to call him a point guard. And I get the sense that they've moved away from that with Neek, that they understand he's more of a wing, and they're not trying to force feed him as a point guard anymore, especially because they have a little bit more depth at that position with Julian and with KJ. But as you pointed out, he has those skills. He can bring the ball up the court, and it's more of a fringe benefit with a three, with him at a three, than it would have been like, oh, we need to rely on him as a point guard. You know, we've seen where that kind of goes with like a Jerron Hopkins type, where we're just like, well, he's tall and he can handle, he's a point guard now. Like we've moved away from that a little bit, which I think is positive for the program. But yeah, I think if you're looking for a pivot player, a player who, if he really blows up, could change this team from being one way to another. Like Neek is kind of that guy where he can really sort of take whatever the mix is and whatever it ends up being rotational wise and take it to another level.
Yeah. So really quick, just to organize all of this, I want to go through some of what we think, let's say the top eight players are going to be. Mm-hmm. So we think a starting point guard, Keyshawn Barthelemy solidified that position. You know, redshirt COVID freshman, whatever you want to call him. He's still technically a freshman, I guess, from Canada.
I think he's a sophomore at this point because he had the COVID year, but I think he is technically a sophomore.
Okay. He's a sophomore, but after his senior year, he could apply for his sixth year.
Yeah.
Is that how they're doing COVID? Okay.
I think so, yes.
Because he redshirted in 2019, played last year as a redshirt freshman. So, yeah, redshirt sophomore. Third year in the program, which makes him a surly vet on this team for sure. Yes, speedy guy, 6'2", what did you say? 6'2", like 180? I don't know. Not thick, for sure.
But I think he's a solid 6'2 as well. Like, he doesn't play small.
No. Yeah, and definitely he's not McKinley Wright in every aspect. We shouldn't try to force him in that role. No one's going to be. But he brings some things. He's a more willing shooter, I think, already off the bounce than McKinley was, for sure. And Taz mentioned it a few times, McKinley Wright wasn't slow, but I think Keyshawn's really, really fast when he wants to be. Him and KJ both just have quite a bit of speed. So I think he's locked in as starting point guard for the season. Shooting guard, Eli Parquet has been locked in there for a while. We all know who that is. Defensive front runner, probably in the running for Pac-12 Defensive Player of the Year. I don't know if he's – I don't know enough about the other teams to know if he's going to be number one. I would assume it's between him and Jaquez at UCLA, but I'm not sure.
He's going to be on the list. He's certainly going to be on the team at the end of the year if he gets a full season in. I think that's somewhat of a reputational kind of thing because it's hard to put up defensive stats unless you're blocking every shot like a DeAndre Ayton would be or something like that. So it's a reputational honor. And there was between last year's postseason stuff and him getting awards there, but also there's a clear understanding that the two seniors on this team, Evan, who we'll get to in a second, and Elijah, are both really strong defenders, and it's one of the standout parts of their game. And reputational wise, he has that, so yeah, he's going to be on that list at the end of the season.
Yeah. Also worth noting is The Athletic. They did a thing on. They pulled all the players in the Pac-12 and the ones who responded, and the top two players were hardest to score on were Eli and Evan.
Yep,
which is always nice to see.
Reputation, it goes down.
I was about to say, Taz is going to put that. That's going to be his motivation when he wakes up. He's just going to put that on in his vanity mirror. I would say he's locked in at shooting guard. We saw a bit more of the dribble in and pull up game at the end of last year. I think it's going to continue a bit this year. I like his shot, so I hope he shoots a bit more.
I like his shot when it's open. I don't know that he can be a guy who suddenly flips a switch and I'm going to put up three or four shots a game, you know, threes a game. Like, I don't think he can be that guy. I don't think he can be a score guard. I think he would get his points, but they've got to be situational.
Nor do I think he has the mentality to try to force his own shot like that, yeah. We mentioned at the top too, he's one of the two senior leaders with Evan Batty. Eli Parquet is definitely more the quiet assassin type. Been challenged to be more vocal this year by Tad Boyle. And we'll see if that works out. You know, I think Evan has enough voice for everyone in the room too, but Eli's definitely more of a do as I am. You know, I'm going to show you how to act. In that Josh Scott mold, I guess it would be a way to put that. But another one of the leaders on this team for sure. At small forward, probably the most unsettled position. We have Tristan Da Silva, 6'8", 6'9", I don't know, kind of still growing from Germany.
He's listed as 6'10" now. And what? Yeah.
That would be nice. I don't believe it, but that would be nice.
I kind of did a double take when I saw that at the scrimmage the other week. I was a little surprised by that. He doesn't feel 6'10", but no. Hey.
He looks 6'7".
I think he's definitely a bit. He's gotten taller than he was last year for sure. I don't think he's 6'7", but he's, I don't know. Like, that puts him in the, regardless, he's pretty tall for a small forward. Gotten bulkier since last year. Another one of those COVID freshmen, so red sophomore, whatever you want to call that. Pretty young, younger brother of Oscar Da Silva, who started at Stanford forever. And I don't know, he's super versatile. We've mentioned that on defense already. On offense, I like him because he just ungums the works a lot. He always kind of moves where there's not a body already and does a pretty good job doing some of those short drives. And interior passing, I think he's a really good interior passer.
Yeah, the big thing with him is just high basketball IQ. Like, cross, he can play a number of different positions. He can even play two if you wanted him to. Like, I think he can really play 2 through 5. Certainly 3 through 5. He can play any number of positions. He can guard any number of different people. He's you know, your Swiss Army knife. He can really kind of fix a lot of problems. And I think that's really what Ted gets him. He's not a star player, but I don't want to completely shade him by saying this, but he's a role player and he'll play whatever role you want. And that's where a guy like Ted really starts to be like, oh, I like this guy.
I mean, yeah, the glue guy. Yeah. He'll make everything fit together.
Yeah, I don't know. That term always seems a little bit like, he's not an end of bench glue guy though. He's not like your Nick Collison dude.
What?
Though, I hope he's Nick Collison.
I'm not talking about that.
Okay. Well, yeah. So how would you describe Tristan's game?
Well, I mean, like, Andre Kirilenko was also a glue guy.
That would be a very fun comparison that I hope becomes true. AK-47.
I haven't thought of AK-47 in a long time. Like,
I think about him every day.
Yeah, he has a full back tattoo that I believe is like a Russian demon bat. So power forward is going to be Jabari Walker, probably the most ballyhooed returner at the CU team. He's somewhere like 6'8", 6'9", and he came on the scene pretty heavily last year as a freshman. In between all of his fouls, he found time to score a bunch of points. And he just completely dominated Georgetown in the NCAA tournament game, which is a great stage to dominate someone in. I think he's probably the most natural scorer on this team. He's capable of being a number one option on offense. The thing I've seen so far this year with him that makes me a bit worried is I think both in Mines and Nebraska, he just checked out a bit at times. Maybe that's because the games don't matter yet, and they're college kids still, but something to keep in mind is, you know, there might be times like that when he just checks out a bit and gets those dumb cheap fouls and has to sit. But I still think he's, I don't know, he can score at all three levels. He's a really fun guy to watch. And when he rebounds hard, he's one of the best rebounders, I think, in the conference.
So, yeah, high motor guy. He's all over the place when he wants to be. He maybe isn't as athletic as you think he is, but he is a really good athlete, can do a lot of different things. Obviously, we've seen the shooting. He can stretch people all over the court. Really good stuff there. The foul trouble. Okay, so where are we getting here? So Mines. Again, we're talking small sample sizes. We're talking exhibitions. The Mines game, I was a little concerned that, okay, here's a situation where his first opportunity to impress in front of a live crowd at home. Well, he picks up a cheap foul. Okay, how is he going to react? Well, his reaction was to keep putting himself in situations where if I was a ref, I would have blown the whistle. You know, he's leaning on guys, and some of it was energy and, okay, he's being a little too aggressive, but then there was a mix of sort of weird, like not lazy, but just like not paying attention, as you noted, maybe not checked in, maybe not as focused moments. And it's like, okay, this should have been something that you were preparing yourself for. How am I going to react in those moments? And the first opportunity I get to see him live and in person, and he's putting himself in positions that I'm immediately like, oh my God. And he did foul out of that game, and he fouled out of that game pretty efficiently. So Yeah, it's going to be a lingering concern. How long is he going to be on the court? Can he stay out of foul trouble? The interesting thing is we have more forward depth than we've had in previous years. So even if he does get in foul trouble, I think we can patch over it for spurts. But yeah, as you pointed, he's one of the key scorers on this team. And if he's not able to be out there, I wonder how efficient and effective we're going to be offensively. So he's got to stay out of foul trouble. He's got to cut that number of six fouls per 40 down to something in at least the high fours. Can we get down to like 4.9 per 40? That would be helpful.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the forward depth, but I'm worried that in games where he's in foul trouble, we're going to have to rely on Luke O'Brien to play some more minutes than we would expect. And I don't want to segue too quickly into the bench, but I don't necessarily feel comfortable with that. I don't know. Tad's not going to want to go small when he doesn't have Jabari, even if that's the best idea.
The thing is, there's a lot of length on this bench. And so I don't know how small we'll have to go. But yeah, and we'll talk about Luke, I'm sure, in a bit.
Yeah, I guess here's a fun question. How many games this year is Jabari going to test the you sit out with two fouls in the first half rule?
Most. Almost every game.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. There you go. Finally at center, we all know him. We all love him. We're all going to cry on his senior day. It is Evan Batty coming back for what feels like his 20th year in CU, but it's really, I believe, his fourth on the court. And Batty is the unquestioned soul, heart of this team, everything. You know, he is the leader if you're going to pick one. And he embraces that role wholeheartedly. He is, you know, an amazing teammate. We'll see him constantly pick other people up off the floor. You'll see him be a ball of energy. At center, he's a fun college ball prospect. He's like 6'8 and 260. I don't know what you want to call him. He's sculpted that 260 from fat to muscle over the last 4 years. And now he's just a big mound of fun. He's on offense, he's high energy. I would say he's comfortable in the post. And on defense, he's one of a great post defender with a lot of length and a lot of size. I don't know how to describe his game if people somehow have not seen his game, but that seems like a good place to start. Just energy and length and size.
Yeah. So I was talking with a couple other guys the other week, the free balling guys. And the thing I said about Evan was, I think he's probably one of the most beloved figures in the history of the university. And I'm not talking about just the basketball program or just athletics. I think he is legitimately one of those guys who supersedes just the athletics mindset and is an entire campus personality. And as you noted, when he graduates, his senior night is going to be an emotional time for everyone who follows this program. In terms of who he is as a player, because I think it's hard to completely summarize who he is as a person and what he means to the program at large, but who he is as a player, very efficient scorer, knows how to use his size on both the offense and defense. I compared him to like an 80s Cadillac. He is wide and he controls the lane. I'm surprised when I saw him at the Coors Event Center a couple weeks ago, like he somehow got even wider. He takes up a lot of space. At one point, Lawson ran into him on a screen situation, and there was this loud cacophonous thud that you could hear across the gym. Evan didn't move. Lawson fell to the ground, and Lawson, we'll get to him. He is not a small dude. Evan is a large boy. He's an efficient scorer. He will struggle sometimes to score against length and athleticism, but I think he's getting smarter at that. His offensive numbers have been essentially the same in terms of efficiency-wise since he showed up. I don't think he can really shoot, although sometimes he falls in love with his shot. I would much prefer him to stay as a pivot, to stay in a drive situation, to stay with his back to the basket and use his moves, you know, those kind of things. I don't want him to fall in love with this shot, but offensively, he is a very efficient scorer, particularly at the rim. You wouldn't know that from looking at a Nebraska game, yeah.
Yeah. Every few games, he's going to have a game where he just throws every shot really hard at the backboard and goes like 1 for 8. That happens.
Defensively, he really helps other guys. He will clear out two players on the rebound side so that someone else can come in and clear out the boards. Like, he is that kind of – he takes up space. He's a willing defender, but he's going to be as helpful offensively as he is defensively because he helps his team out by taking one or two guys on, eating up that space, pushing them off, and all of a sudden you'll see a situation where he clears out a good 3-4 feet under the basket, and all of a sudden the guard comes in and grabs an easy rebound. Like, every time you see a guard with an easy rebound, it's probably because Evan's clearing out one or two dudes from underneath. So he's all over the court. He's going to do so many different things. He's almost a coach on the court at times. Throughout the practice and throughout the exhibition against Mines, he was constantly in the ears of all the other forwards saying, like, you needed to be here. You need to be here. Let's go. He's picking up his teammates' bundle of emotion and energy. I can't say enough about him. I love him to death. And it's going to be painful when he leaves.
Yep.
But it is what it is. College, yep. 4 years.
There's the, I'm sure, soon to be famous story that we're probably going to hear on a bunch of different announcers as they struggle for anecdotes about CU. But there, I think at media days, Tad mentioned that he was potentially holding open the director of player development spot for a full year after Nate Tomlinson vacated that, to wait for Evan Batty to graduate before he filled it, and he would fill it with Evan Batty directly after graduation.
And that's a big spot on your coaching staff to even contemplate leaving open. Eventually went to Zach Rubisam, who's a long-term friend of the program, is a buff, is a true buff. Glad to see him back, but couldn't go to a better candidate. But yeah, if Tad is thinking that far in advance and is offering that to Evan to leave it open for a year, like, that's saying something.
Yeah. That, I don't know what else needs to be said about their relationship. It's, you know, they're going to be – he's going to be in Boulder for a long time. Everyone loves him. And last anecdote, I think he's probably the best charge taker on the team. I mean, he's ridiculously good at getting those charges for how big he is too, because we all know realistically no one's ever going to get him down. So, great leader to have being the anchor of your starting five. And then we get into the bench. Sixth man, I would say, I guess, you know, whatever you want to call that. First off the bench, we have some combination of Neek Clifford, KJ Simpson, and Lawson Loughring is what I'm going to say. No. And I guess that probably depends on the matchup, maybe, who comes in first. But let's just start with Neek Clifford. We've mentioned him a little bit. He's a swing forward, one of those swing forwards from Colorado, highly rated recruit, still growing into his body a little bit. And full of latent potential. I think he's seeing that a bit more. He's definitely more developed this year. And I just like seeing the consistent effort he's bringing, because when you bring that, it's a little bit easier for your shot to fall and for you to get enough minutes for you to make an impact. So I think he's going to be fun to watch on both sides of the ball this year.
You said growing to his body, like, he gained 15 pounds, and it's clear over the offseason. Like, he's bigger, he's more mature. I think he can certainly hang in physically with Pac-12 teams now. I think, okay, well, where is his shot going to be, and can he consistently get into the lane, and can he distribute? Will he have the court vision? Like, I still have some questions, but along the lines is what you mentioned. I have high hopes for him this year. I think he's going to take a nice step forward. More to the point, Tad has said repeatedly that he thinks that Neek is primed for that moment, that he's a sleeper that people are not paying attention to enough. We talked about he's gonna get minutes, and if he really starts taking that next step, he could fight for a starting spot pretty quickly.
And then next, I'm just going to put in KJ Simpson right there. He's a steal on the recruiting trail from another late defection from a Miller brother recruiting class, the gift that keeps giving. KJ Simpson was committed to Arizona, signed. Sean Miller is fired unceremoniously. KJ Simpson releases. He comes into the CU program after Tad Boyle cut the relationship with him. Lightning bug out of California, scraping the bottom of 6 feet, maybe. I would say he's a little bit below that. but still a combo guard. And yeah, he's just, I think, electric with the ball in his hand. Definitely pushes the pace early and often, always going at 100. He's going to go for more steals than you'll see any other player go for, and that can be good and bad. But in general, he's just constantly going to bring energy. And I, the thing, this is going to be a really small thing, but the thing I loved watching before this season started against Nebraska and Mines is his shot is like 0 seconds to get up in the air.
That's what I said. That's what I said after seeing the open practice.
Yeah.
He's just like short arms, just it's gone. It's so nice to see.
I mean, it's not a huge deal in college, but it's super fun because it takes him no time to get that shot up and it looks pretty good. But it
looks good.
Yeah, those are my thoughts about KJ. I think we're going to see a lot of him this year.
I think he's a more – sorry, Ben. Mm-hmm. He's a more natural point guard than Keyshawn, and I think that that could end up being a pretty big deal, especially when you have the two-guard lineups, like when KJ and Keyshawn are on the court together. I think KJ is probably going to need to learn some lessons in that regard and carry the offense a bit more than we – I don't know. Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah, they're different players. You know, Keyshawn to KJ, they're different players. I think, again, I don't want to saddle him with this, but Keyshawn's more of a Don Collier type in terms of he's going to be more of a traditional point guard as opposed to a KJ who's going to be more of an instigator like Ken would be in trying to get into the lane and trying to get to the rack. Difference there might be a little bit more that KJ has a better shot, I think, ultimately, but we'll see there. You know, we talked about
and then,
bundle of energy. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. And Keyshawn driving is more looking for fouls, looking for layups, which he's going to be pretty good at.
Right. And both of them can get into the lane. I don't want to create too much of a dichotomy there. Both of them are going to try to attack. I'm looking at Keyshawn as more of a, he's a little bit more comfortable on the perimeter. Whereas KJ is constantly, he has that burp his ass. He constantly wants to attack. So that's where the difference there is. In terms of KJ, as I mentioned earlier, I think he's a spark plug off the bench, microwave type, you know, in the mold of freshman, you know, Ski, that kind of thing. Every time a Miller loses a job, we get a new point guard. So thank you to that family. I can't wait to see their next job because then I can start planning on where our next point guard is going to
come. Ugh, and they're both unemployed, so we can keep.
Are they both unemployed?
They're both currently unemployed, yeah.
Could they be CU's football coach? And then that way we have a million point guards.
Well, we have Drew Carter on the football team.
That's so true. And Julian Hammond could also swap. But we'll get to him in a sec. But yeah, I don't know. I think Simpson's going to be the easiest freshman for fans, casual or not, to get excited about just because his impact is so easily seen. There's everything that goes with it. His floppy hair, like, gets back perfectly as he sprints, so it just looks like he's going even faster, like he has speed trails. I don't know. It's super fun to watch him. He has a nice floater game already, too. He's comfortable scoring at all three levels. And he dunks for a 5'11 guy. He dunks pretty often. So something we did not see McKinley or Skia do much of in college. Mm-hmm. I think last point guard that dunked frequently was either Dinwiddie or Shannon Sharp. So
Tron Hopkins would throw down.
Was he a point guard though? I thought you.
Well, it depends on if you accept. It depends on if you accept the pre-prescribed role that they try to fit him into.
Okay, that was the experiment. Was that he was a point guard? Did it fail or not? Who knows? But that was the experiment.
I think we know.
Well, yeah, good at Fresno State. So the last guy probably coming off the bench, another freshman. I should say, Nick Clifford is a sophomore / COVID freshman. KJ is a true freshman. Lawson Levering, the last guy, is another true freshman. And out of the three exhibitions I saw, which was the Costa Rica, the Mines, and then the Nebraska game before the season, I came away the most sure of Lawson's improvement throughout the year as someone's going to be a huge impact at the end of the year that may not be at the beginning of the year. He's 7 feet tall easily, and I think he has arms that are even longer than that. But he is the opposite of a plotter. I was consistently impressed in Mines in Nebraska at his activity level on both ends of the floor and just the amount of like space he takes up. And we didn't get to see much of his offensive game. Tad has said he can shoot. I haven't seen that yet. But I think he's just a great developmental piece. He was a huge recruit coming out of high school. And I think we're going to see that in the next few years as he gains pounds because, God, he is active and huge.
Yeah, he's a big dude. He is all of 7'1". Like there is sometimes you see a 7-footer in college, quote unquote, and you know they're really 6'10", maybe wearing some extensions or being measured weird. with Lawson. He is all of that height. He is a big dude. But as you noted, he has very quick feet for a big guy. He's got a really nice frame. I think he'll I think he'll continue to grow in college. First moment I looked at him, I went, oh, he could be Caleb Tarzewski in like 3 or 4 years in terms of size, because he's got a really nice frame. In terms of who he is as a player right now, length. Yeah, length is big thing. He's shown off a couple times pivot moves where he just uses his arms and they go for days. He uses his arms to just essentially go around dudes. You know, again, good feet work. I haven't really been too impressed with his shot yet. As you noted, people have said he can shoot. I've seen it on recruiting videos. Okay, he can hit shots. I don't know if it's there yet. I certainly wouldn't trust it too much right now. But in terms of what is he going to provide day in, day out, on the offensive side and the defensive side, it's going to be length. I think they're going to play a lot of zone with him defensively. I think he's going to be the centerpiece of his zone. They're going to try to use his size to take up the sort of space Evan would just take up naturally by running around. I think just putting him at the center of the zone, having him stick out his arms, having him move around with his feet work, they're going to rely on that with zone a little bit. And then offensively, yeah, he's going to use his length to get around guys. He's going to use his footwork to get around guys. Now, the last time we saw a cornerstone center prospect like this, we're talking Josh Scott. They are not comparable in terms of their instant impact. It is going to take Lawson a little. He is not the polished offensive product that Josh Scott was when he arrived on campus. He's going to take a little bit of time to develop, but that's also natural for centers at this level. You rarely see a center come in and dominate right out of the gate. So don't be surprised if November, halfway through December, he's still trying to feel things out. But yeah, come towards the end of the year, we're going to really start to see some big climbs from him. I can't wait to see how he develops with us, because he is going to be a monster.
Yeah, he missed a few bunnies against mine that was just like, man, you give him a little bit more weight in the legs where he gets up a bit more, and those are just like easy turnaround. I don't know. He has touch. He has feet, like you mentioned a million times. It's just so quick. I don't know. I was just like, I haven't seen a center prospect like that at CU. I don't think I have, period. I think Josh Scott's the last really good one. Totally different player. I don't know. You think of 7 foot white dudes, you think of Shane Harris Tunks, and you think of Ben Mills, and he's not
different.
Ben
Mills. Completely different. Yeah.
Right. He's not one of those lugs that's just there to, he moves and he's so fluid. I don't know. I just came away so impressed with what I saw. Sam, anything to add before we go into some of the more bit players?
I mean, no, he's very active. Like, he is going to learn really quickly. Defensively, I think, like, that's always going to be really difficult, especially coming from Wyoming and not really playing against the highest level of competition. He's going to get tested in the pick and roll, and I think he might struggle for a bit, but he's going to be learning really valuable lessons that will build upon his game.
Yeah, and that's just a weapon that not a lot of college schools have, so it's fun to have CU have a nice big 7-footer. let's round it out with, I think we have 4 scholarship players left. I think we can expect to see Luke O'Brien and Julian Hammond play quite a bit out of those 4. So let's start with Luke O'Brien, another local kid at a Columbine High School, was kind of a do-everything point guard for them, became another small forward up here. He's all a 6'7", definitely super built. He has to be up past 200 pounds. I think he's a good energy guy. I like when he slashes a lot. I think he's a good offensive rebounder. The big thing Tad has mentioned multiple times is his shooting coming out of high school. I have yet to see that show up. And I don't know if it will, but he can still do good work with being an activity guy, I think. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think we expected him to be like, Jack, I know you picked him as like, oh, we'll have like a catch and shoot like threat. Yeah. Like that'll be so nice to have, but it turns out that he's just white. That's why we thought
that. Well, I mean, Tad mentioned a million times that he shot so often in high school, but his percentages were never that great. And I was like, he's just getting covered a lot. It just has not translated. Anyways, sorry.
But yeah, he's big, he's athletic, and he's handsome. And I don't really know much else about his game, to be honest. I think we'll learn.
I think the image of Luke in our heads is often better than the product you'll actually see on the floor. Like I in my mind, I see a player ready to go, and then I see him on the court and he's not there yet. His shot, he's got a quick release, but I think it's rushed at this point. I think he's trying to get the ball out of his hand so fast that it's not balanced, and he's not taking effective quality shots at the basket. He did fill out a little bit, you know, sort of like Neek. He put on about 15, 20 pounds, and he looks the part. Like, he looks the part. I want him to have opportunities, because, you know, part of the justification for turning away a Deshaun or a Jiraiya is we want to get a player like Luke more time on the court. Okay, but what is he going to do with that time? My vision of him is probably ahead of where he is as a player right now. Could he still develop into something? Sure, but time is starting to dribble through the hourglass. So yeah, with Quincy sideline, he's got an opportunity, but he's got to take advantage of it right now.
The other piece we have is yet another local product that continues to dominate the top of the state of Colorado. We have Julian Hammond coming in. And every time I keep thinking, like, oh, is it Donald? But I know it's not Donald Hammond. That is an Air Force quarterback that beat CU at CU in 2019. Uh-huh. It is Julian Hammond. And Julian Hammond was a quarterback and a point guard for Cherry Creek for 4 years. Comes into CU, focuses on basketball. A bit taller, I think, than some of the other guards we have. He's around Keyshawn's size, maybe a little taller. And another thing, coming out of high school, he was another guy that was pegged as a shooter. I'm definitely seeing that a bit more with him than with Luke O'Brien or some other players. And, you know, this is going to be mean to everyone, but I'm still going to plow ahead. But I think what I've seen so far is he's kind of what I wanted Xavier Tolden to be. In terms of a guy that will get you 15 minutes or 20 minutes, and he'll do okay in every ask. He'll run the plays you ask him to run. He'll move the ball. It won't ever stick, and he won't get completely destroyed. You know, he's not going to be the guy that people pick on a defense, I think. But still young, and I think that the headline on him is he's a pretty good shooter, and he won't lose you games. Two things I keep thinking of.
If you could tell me right now that he'd have Xavier Tolton's career, I'd take it in a heartbeat. Right. He heaped a lot of crap on Xavier when he was in school, but he was a good player, and he forged a pretty strong career for himself at CU. Mm-hmm. You know, Julian, having played football for so long and split for so long, this is really his first opportunity to really focus on basketball. So it's a little bit of a project. I did like what I've seen so far, like the scrimmage and, you know, the exhibition against Mines particularly. Like, I liked what I saw from him, you know, speed. He's got really good speed, really good quickness. I think he can be a fringe one or a two to spell, you know, when we need someone to be in there for a couple minutes a game. I think he needs time, but then ultimately, yeah, I think Xavier Tolton is kind of probably a good comp for him ultimately mm-hmm. about where he could be. And if he achieves that level, that's a pretty strong use of his time here.
Yeah, Sam, anything to add?
No, but we can move on to Javon Ruffin, who I hope will play. I hope he'll come back healthy sooner than later, because I don't really trust Julian Hammond yet. I don't think he's going to be ready to play major minutes. So.
Well, you know, I guess that's kind of what I'm trying to say is, like, I think if at the end of his career, Hammond is a guy, maybe Dom Collier is the same thing, where it's like you put him on the court for 15 minutes or 20 minutes, the offense is still going to run, you're still going to get pretty good shots, and he's still going to defend. I think that's really good. I think that's a really good thing to be. But, yeah, so let's get to Javon Ruffin, the other guard signed, another true freshman. He had a knee injury. It was a leg injury. I sidelined him for all of the summer practices and games in Costa Rica. We saw him briefly against Colorado School of Mines. I don't know if he ever took the court against Nebraska. He didn't? Okay. And, yeah, he has the best hair on the team, for sure. He has still a massive brace on there that he's going to take a long time to work through. So his learning curve is even steeper than a lot of the other freshmen. But he has the best size of all the guards that have signed. So he's 6'4", easy. Definitely a bit
big
slower.
Big wingspan,
yeah. And another guy coming out of high school that was kind of pegged as a shooter. Definitely shot a lot in high school. He moved around, played in New Orleans, played in Phoenix because his dad is an NBA scout. So I don't know. It seems like another classic Tad point guard prospect, tall guy. Not a huge athlete, but just can get to the spots he needs to. But, you know, we haven't seen much.
Yeah, more of a two or three. When I first got my eyes on him during the scrimmage, the open scrimmage, the player that immediately jumped to my mind was Jeremy Adams. And that's both for good and bad. Like, Jeremy was a good, versatile basketball player, but he was also constantly injured and never really got to play healthy, free basketball. And when I saw Javon take the court, that's what I saw, a player who isn't capable of playing healthy, free basketball right now. You know, he's limited because of the injury, his recovery. And ultimately I think that's where his season's probably going to go, is a red shirt. That'd be my expectation. And that's even before Tad said as much this year that they're going to be talking about that. They've still got a little time to think about it, but yeah, and Jeremy Adams, again, a really good basketball player. If you told me right now that he could be Jeremy Adams, like, I'd take that. You know, another player that comes to mind is a Marcus Rulford, a guy who's versatile, you know, wing player who can rebound, who can do a lot of different things, who can bring the basketball to court, do a bunch of stuff. Both of those players came to mind when I was watching him. But again, I would caution you against any expectations this year, because I think recovery has got to be his number one focus.
Any final thoughts, Sam?
No, I think I saw his high school clips and I see like a big guard who can like initiate and shoot a little bit. But I haven't seen him in person really. And I don't think we will for a while. I hope that he can play, because like my idea of Javon Ruffin is a better player than my idea of Julian Hammond, even though I have really no evidence to say either of which is better. So yeah, that's kind of where I am with like the 10th and 11th guys on this team. Of like mostly unproven players, it's just hard to tell anything.
Well, right, and we don't really need to for 2021, 2022. Yeah. So yeah, he's not going to be the key to success or the reason for failure, no matter what. Unless I miss anyone, the last guy is Quincy Allen. Am I missing anyone? No,
that's all 12. Yeah.
And he is out for the year with a hip injury. We've talked about him a bit. Was the second commitment in this class. He was really early. He visited before COVID.
Lawson was first and then Quincy.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. Highly rated out of DC, which is a far pull for Tad Boyle. We talked about him when he signed. I still think if there's a guy, he would be the guy that'd be most, I would vote most likely to drop 30 in a given night. I think he's just such a natural scorer. Good athlete, great shooter. That's a good recipe for offensive success. The thing that people have knocked him on coming out of high school is his motor. It runs off and on. So maybe a year away from the game will ignite some more fire, but we won't see him at all this year. Still an exciting piece in the years to come.
Yeah, the big thing that surprised me about him was I saw him without crutches at the scrimmage. That's not to say he's going to come back this year or anything like that, but hope is that recovery is well on its way. It's a blow that he's not able to be a part of this crew this year. As we said, that I think wing is really where we could use some help, and he would have I think paired nicely with Tristan and some of the other guys in the three role this year. But nonetheless, we got to move forward without him, and I really look forward to being able to see him next season.
So that is the cast and characters of this year's TV show. Let's look at the plot. Zooming out. Let's just walk through this. What do we think is a realistic expectation for this team? What are we looking to see from the 21-22 Colorado Buffaloes this season?
Sure.
And I'll start go ahead. Yep.
Yeah, so we are a recruit and develop team, and this is a recruit and develop year, right? Tad said it a thousand times, you know, we're not a rent-a-jersey program. We're a buy-in program, and this is the year that really starts to develop. And I don't want to shortchange Elijah and Evan on their senior seasons, but this is about development. So if you come into this season having come off the high of last year looking for a repeat, you are going to be disappointed. please let's play the expectation game appropriately right now and sort of set our views slightly lower. I'm not saying this team's going to go under 500 or anything like that, but you know, we need to appropriately sort of look at, you know, what as you put it, reasonable expectation for this team. More to the point, you can't replace a player like Kim. And the last time we tried, the year after the Spencer Dinwiddie experiment came to its end, it was a freaking nightmare. We end up in the CBI. We're losing to Seattle. Everyone's yelling at each other. Everyone hates each other. It's an absolute nightmare. It's the worst season of Tad Boyle's tenure with us.
Mm-hmm.
I do not think we will see that either. We're going to be somewhere in the middle, right? I think somewhere around 17 to 18 wins is a good baseline expectation. You will see this team improve as the year goes on, particularly as players like Lawson and KJ start to come into their own, Neek start to come into their own and really make an impact. This team's going to improve it as it goes along. You're going to see games in February where we are knocking off teams that in December we wouldn't have had a chance to look at. So, what is reasonable? 17, 18-ish wins, maybe a fringe NIT appearance, mid-table in the Pac-12. I'll take that. I think that's a solid goal.
Sam?
Yeah, I like the mid-table in the Pac-12, mostly because we don't really know much about the rest of the Pac-12. We know two teams are going to be great, a few teams are going to be really good, and the rest is complete question marks. But we don't have to get into that. But, I think I'm in the same boat. Hopefully you can push towards 20 wins. Mm-hmm. The non-con schedule is pretty tough, but we just want growth this season. We want to see players be tremendously better in March than they were in October or November now. I really just have some concerns with like replicating, like you can't do a direct replacement for McKinley Wright. But I do wonder if this team has enough ball handling, if it has enough playmaking just in general. And I don't know if that can be like the offensive system can replace what one player did, because I don't think that that's really how a Tad offense is going to go. But that's my main concern, really. And I think that we'll see players grow into those roles.
Mm. All right, I'll go last, and I guess I'll just bring a little more hard predictions in. So I think that the schedule sets up for a pretty so-so record, at least through the beginning of conference play. There are some teams that are easy traps in non-conference. I am now just super terrified of UW-Milwaukee because Patrick Baldwin Jr. And there's some obvious losses. I think Tennessee, Kansas, and UCLA you can just pencil in right now, but I think UCLA might count as a conference game. And that preseason tournament where we either meet Creighton or CSU in the finish line, that'll tell us a lot, but also might not because of the way this team might grow. That's going to be a tough test. So you balance that with some free wins in non-conference, and you're looking at, I would assume, a pretty above average, above 500 record, but not, you know, we're not going to go 13-0 or something. And then the conference play starts harder than I think it did last year, and it ends easier than I think it did last year. If I remember right, CU has all a lot of the home games backloaded and also has a lot of the easier teams backloaded, which is good for a team like this that's going to grow throughout the year. So I think you're going to see a nice push at the end of the year, maybe some Pac-12 conference championship wins or tournament wins, and you'll land right at that 18-19 threshold and hope you get into the NIT for some postseason experience. That's kind of what I'm expecting.
Yeah, you real quick, you mentioned the opportunity to potentially see CSU down in the Virgin Islands. In a normal situation, had COVID not impacted it last year and the schedule had been more or less normal this season as well, we would have been going back up to Fort Collins. Mm-hmm. That CSU team is going to be pretty good. That would be a
really good
freaking nightmare. And I'm glad we're not going back up there. same thing with Kansas. I'm glad that last year's team or 2 years ago team went to Lawrence rather than had something worked out where this team had to go to Lawrence. My God,
and Tennessee, frankly,
Tennessee. Well, yeah, even last year with Tennessee, although that was a late replacement game, like that would have been real tough for a team like this. So. you know, having Kansas at home, having Tennessee at home, are those potentially wins? You never want to count out Colorado at altitude at the CEC. But yeah, as you noted, you know, let's kind of pencil those in as losses. Fair enough. I think UCLA is sort of similar. Really good team this year. So if you're looking at the non-conference schedule, and especially if we run into CSU down in the Virgin Islands, that's four losses, you know, right away. You're talking 9-4. And then you usually have some hiccup along the way. So now you're talking 8-5 non-conference before we get to, well, 8-5, including two conference games before you get to the new year and the full conference slate. If you can pencil us in for 8-10, that means you're talking 16-15 all in. Is that acceptable? And maybe that's more of a question for you guys. Yeah. Is would you be happy with a 16-15 season from this bunch?
I think it's go ahead.
I think the floor, it really, okay, Jack, go ahead. I need to think about what I'm saying.
I think it would depend on the 16 that you see. I'm expecting boneheaded losses. I think our annual loss sacrifice to Cal is in the cards again. I don't expect this team to be a straight line to improvement, but I also think you'll have some opportunities. This team might just have a night where they're on fire and these freshmen can't miss and they just play. You know, I think there's a night where they punch up, and Tad's always pretty good at punching up. Sure. So it's going to be a different punching up, though, than some previous Tad years where it's like defense rebounding travels. I think a lot that might be shakier this year, but I also think you might see some explosions from players that just have it going on. I don't know. Yeah, I think 16-15, if they beat a few ranked teams, I would be okay with that. And it also, you know, if we're looking at Pac-12, if they end that with like getting to the semifinals of the Pac-12 tournament, I'd be super okay with that.
If we could repeat last year, that'd be pretty fun. I guess my overall worry is that the fan base, because they've been away for a year, and certainly Colorado basketball is not the marquee program like football is. Like, we've seen it. Football is still carrying 50,000 people in the stands, even though they are who they are. I'm worrying that there is going to be a narrative dissonance with the fan base, with the overall fan base, with the student section, with the alumni base, that you know, might take some time to really buy into what's going on this year. Really interesting pieces, really interesting growth season. We've got a really interesting schedule, as we've talked about. That should be something that you buy into. You want to come to the arena every night, and I hope people do buy into that. But my worry is, if it's a 16-15 season and we're losing games at home to, you know, Washington for no freaking reason, like, are people going to buy that, especially because they didn't get to physically see last year's team in person? Like, I do have a little bit in the back of my mind, like, if this thing is going to go off the rails, it's going to be aided and abetted by that kind of scenario.
Sam, your thoughts?
Well, I'm looking at the schedule. The first four games in like January with students back on campus, the first four home games are USC, UCLA, Oregon, and Oregon State. That could be.
You could go 0-4 right there. You could.
You could go 0-4, and you could just have a really fun time with some really big games, even if they lose all four. Yeah. Like we talk about like the 16-15 record. That would be pretty bad in my opinion, considering the veteran, the veteran talent on the team. But the McKinley Wright, Tyler Bay freshman team, they went 17-15, and we were so hyped about that.
Yeah,
well, because they beat number 4 Arizona State, right? And they beat number 10 Arizona. That's what I was trying to say. Is like, yeah, you have some of those wins. I don't care really. If you have some of those, go 16-15.
It's interesting you bring that team up. I mean, that team came to fight every night. Yeah, they didn't win. They didn't win every game, but you know, even games like South Dakota State that year, like not a lot of people who aren't basketball.
Mike Dom.
Yeah, exactly. Not a lot of people who aren't basketball heads would have probably looked past that game on the schedule. I couldn't wait to get in the arena that night, and that game was more than enough for me. And it proved to me that team is ready to go. If we have a night like that against Tennessee, or if we have a night like that against, you brought up UW Milwaukee, you know, where it's a really intense basketball game that we sort of eke out against a really good opponent, Like, that'll tell me more about this team than almost anything else will. And if we get that sort of energy, that competitiveness, that fight, particularly out of the freshman early, that's going to go a long way to telling me where this program is going to be over the next two seasons.
Yeah. I think going back to what I was trying to say a little bit earlier when I was stumbling around is that I have a lot of major questions about this offense. I think the defense will sort itself out and we'll see more Tad ball going forward. Mm-hmm. I think that the offensive questions for me really, it could cap the ceiling pretty bad for the season. If again, Keyshawn doesn't develop as a ball handler, if Jabari Walker proves inconsistent or like he just literally isn't on the floor, like I can't look up and down the roster and think, oh, this guy's going to be good for some, like, for 10 points every night. Like, I don't think that there's a single player on the team who can be really depended on consistently.
That's a fair point. Yeah, it's a fair point. That scoring is going to be by committee a lot of nights. We don't have a guy who's going to get you 20 every night. That's a worry, particularly at this level. And that's why it's defense first. You see this team playing defense, that's going to go a long way to how competitive are they going to be in a month or two's time.
Yeah, and well, then, again, the shooting too. Like if your forwards or if your big men are your best shooters on the team, that's usually not good.
I think Key will surprise you. Like I think Keyshawn will surprise you.
His shot's fun. I mean, it's
he's smooth.
He launches. I think we've discussed the floor by proxy. I think with 16 to 15, though, some of us might have a lower floor, but I'm going to cap it there. Let's look at the ceiling. Let's look at a best case. If Jabari does become a night in, night out scorer, chops down the fouls. If KJ becomes the sixth man, Pac-12 sixth man of the year. If Eli's Pac-12 defensive player of the year, you know, we're locking people down. We have enough offense to scrape by. What are we looking at here? What is it? NCAA tournament again? Ceiling?
Friends. Yeah.
Go ahead. I think that the Pac-12 could have simultaneously a perception bump and a quality dip this year. And I think that would be a nice little middle ground to hit.
Wouldn't that be ironic? Yeah. Wouldn't that be ironic? Finally, the nation starts paying attention to Pac-12 basketball and we're not as good as maybe we were the last couple of years. Cause this is a good fun league the last couple of years.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. If UCLA and Oregon are like top 10 teams all year, I think that would be fucking great. But if like the third best team is like Arizona and they're not very good, or it's Washington State and they're just like pretty good, I think that could be nice.
I have higher hopes than for Arizona than I think a lot of other people. I think, yeah, it's first year program, but there's a lot of talent down there. I think they'll shine out a little bit. USC will also be dangerous too.
I think Mathurin is a contender for Pac-12.
We love him. He's a Ralphie Report favorite. But we're going to continue.
There you go. In terms of a best case scenario, if Colorado finishes like fourth in the league, which I think is probably their season, if somehow we contrive to finish fourth, and that's probably a reach. I think that would be the absolute ceiling. And I think that would be a season where like everything went right.
Right.
I think more realistically your best case scenario or you're like 80 percentile top range kind of thing. That's more like a fifth place finish in the conference. And maybe given the fact that the league is a little bit more well-respected now after last year's March runs, you might talk about 12 seed. Yep. I could see that. I don't think it's much higher than that. We don't, especially since you don't know how the team's going to react to post-Ken life and you kind of suspect how it's going to react to post-Ken life. I can't in good conscience say any better than that because it's going to take some time.
Wasn't this past year the first time we ever even had a first round bye in the Pac-12 tournament?
Yep. It's first time we've had a conference tournament bye since my sophomore year of college, which was 2004.
David Harrison.
It was yes, it was. It was David's last year. Yep.
I think my ceiling is somewhere around 20 wins. You hit that threshold again, you're already you're golden, especially with this team. I think you're looking at surprising. You know, you a win against CSU at the Virgin Islands would be huge. And then you're looking at a surprise win against maybe a Tennessee, and then you're already like, wow, yeah, this team is legit. And you look at, I don't know, 11-7 conference record, and I'd be pretty happy with that.
That's, yeah, that's the best case scenario.
I'm trying to think if I mean ceiling four, we have expectations. We had record. Any other macro things, Sam, we want to ask our resident expert here?
Are you afraid of PJ Baldwin in Milwaukee?
I'm afraid of everyone this time of year.
Montana State, watch out.
Hey, last time Montana, I think his name was Bobby Howard. Last time Montana State came and played us in basketball.
And football,
obviously. It was a scare show. I remember walking to the gym. I think it was 07. I remember walking to the gym like, oh, this is our opportunity to get football, revenge for the football loss. And then Bobby Howard goes off, this random no-name dude from Montana State, and we get knocked around. Different time, different era, different program. but nonetheless, yeah, this time of year, I'm scared of everyone. Until we take the court and we really understand where this team is, we can lose to anybody. We can also beat a lot of these teams on this schedule that maybe we're not talking about, like USC. Tad doesn't lose to USC, right? Well, we'll mm-hmm. see. You know, I'm interested to see how the season's going to go. And yeah, everyone scares me right now.
are you looking at the schedule at all?
Mm-hmm.
Is there any like 5-game stretch that you're really most looking at?
In terms of, it's hard not to look at that Kansas home game. You hit the holidays and then you come back for Oregon State away. Like, you're going to learn a lot about these kids in those three games. If you're looking for a 5-game stretch, you know, there's that, you guys kind of brought it up earlier, those home games against, those home games against USC, UCLA, Oregon State, sandwiched around the road trip to Washington. I'm actually going on that road trip to Washington.
Oh, nice.
State. That'll be a really interesting stretch, because I think by that time, which is end of January, early February, you're going to be seeing the team pretty much as it's going to be, like in terms of its full development. If we're not firing on all cylinders by then, like, you know, there's something going wrong with development. So that's going to be where everyone is. Development wise, that's going to be the key point to, like, what is this team going to look like in 2022, 2023? We're going to know at that point what that team's going to look like. And if we're able to clip off a couple of those home games and sweep the Washingtons, that's a really positive stretch.
Sweep the Washington State might be really good. Yeah.
Yeah. I guess that's my last question. Just looking at the conference as a whole, I think CU was picked 6th in the media poll, which I thought was very generous. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate that. And I think we somehow got one AP vote still also, which I assume was just left over from last year, but I appreciate that as well. I think we all have CU slotted in that mid tier of the conference, but just for fun, is there a team that you're like higher on than what appears to be the consensus in the conference? Is there a team that you're lower on than the conference consensus? But I'll go last.
As I mentioned, I think Arizona is going to surprise some people. We've national media forgot about them. I think fan bases forgot about them because of not being postseason eligible last year and all that kind of stuff. I think they're going to be back. I think they're going to be fine. They'll be strong. They'll be a strong team. In terms of programs that I think are probably too highly ranked, I'm not as sold on Washington State as others. Although it's always a tough trip to Pullman. Oregon State as well. I think they got a lot of credit for a couple games in March last year. Cool. And I'm glad that the Silver Fox up there was able to save his job. Good for him.
Bumped all of our KenPoms. Thank you.
Yeah. I think that there's going to be a rude awakening when they see the court again, especially with the Thompson brothers out of there at this point. They're going to fall back a bit, and we'll see how they end up being, and maybe they'll prove me wrong. But that's a team that I think is going to underwhelm.
Sam?
I agree on both of those, on Oregon State and Arizona. I am a little bit I'm a little bit worried that UCLA was a fringe NCAA tournament team and their offense was a bit hit or miss. So I don't know if they should be a top five team. I think they'll be really good, but we'll see. And then I'm always generally lower on USC, but that's because I don't believe in Andy Enfield's basketball program.
Yeah, you guys are taking all of my picks. I actually am going to go the opposite way. I know. Well, except for, yeah, we all know that Cal's last, I guess, is unfortunate for Cal. But the team that I'm in love with is I actually love Washington State. And part of that's just because of the way they play. They're probably at this point being overrated as a media darling. But I don't know. I love that roster. Noah Williams is super fun. I love the grad transfers they brought in. DeSean Jackson is really fun. And Dennis Rodman's kid is on there, which is fun. And Efe Abogide is just an athletic. He just skies. I don't know. And Kyle Smith is kind of the same way as Tad. It's defense first. It's slow it down a bit. I don't know. I really like them. I hope they go all the way. I think they're an NCAA tournament team this year. The team, if you took Oregon State, which is going to be my easy answer, I'm so down on them. I'm going to be fading them pretty hard because their main guy is who? Is that, is it Alatiche? I love Alatiche.
It has to be Alatiche. And he's
good enough.
Yeah. I mean, the tournament run was Ethan Thompson making nutso shots for 40 minutes, and it worked. But that's what it was. So that's not going to be possible this year, and that's not going to help him.
Another one, Washington could be better than expected too, just mostly because they brought in competent guards.
Yeah, I'm anti-Mike Hopkins, though. I mean, maybe.
They haven't had quality guards like at all in like 3 years, I think. But it's like Dejon Davis and Brandon Terrell or Terrell Brown.
I don't think Mike Hopkins is really understood what he wants his program to be. Like, I don't think he's had a very coherent vision. It'll be interesting to see if he finally is sort of like, this is what I want my program to be. This is what we're doing going forward, because he's tried to plug and play with different people, bring in transfers, and it's never really fit. Like, it's never really gelled. Particularly since, some of the big guys graduated a couple years ago. Mm-hmm. I get the sense that his time's running out.
Do you know what his contract looks like though?
I don't. No. I don't have it. No.
He gets paid like $7 million a year. They can't buy him out. They can't buy him out.
Oh, well, then,
well, then their AD needs to get fired. But
absolutely. Yeah. Okay.
I want to mention Matisse Thybulle because it looks like he can't coach a good defense without Matisse Thybulle.
Well, Matisse Thybulle, he plastered over a whole bunch of other issues. I mean, he's a singular player, right? He's NBA caliber talent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you're going to have steps backwards from that. I just don't think he had a very concise vision about how he's going to attack developing his program beyond that season. And it's shown, right?
Yeah. Okay, Hopkins is guaranteed $12 million in buyout money on his contract.
Oh, no.
That's Carl Durrell money. Not that I'm looking at his buyout. That is disgusting. And that sounds like they're going to have to replace Jimmy Lake and Mike Hopkins in short order pretty soon. It's borderline negligent and criminal that a basketball program based in Seattle is poor, is bad, like poor performing. It's insane because so many people come out of that city.
I mean, you should say the same thing about Cal Berkeley. How could you have that much basketball talent there?
I agree.
Yeah, that's malpractice.
20 years.
That's East Bay malpractice. There's no reason that Cal should be that bad.
I just don't know. Yeah, I guess I don't know. Cal just doesn't seem interested in participating. So that's why I'm going hard after Washington. But
was that our final thoughts? Final thoughts, shout out to Wilhelm Breidenbach at Nebraska, who is way too fucking goofy to be on a bad team like that.
If you couldn't laugh, if you couldn't laugh looking at him just throwing in buckets on Saturday,
and talking like, trash on his way back.
Yeah,
he's a top 100 recruit too. Yeah. He's going to be good for a long time. It's crazy.
It's hilarious. If you can't laugh watching that kid play, you're in the wrong business.
Sucks that Fred Hoiberg actually has talent in that program and they aren't just a wasteland like they have been, but I guess it's a good test And yeah, I get that's the last bit we saw of CU before their game against Montana State, November 9th. That's the month we're in. November 9th at home. Thank you so much, Ben, for coming on. We kept you longer than expected, but that's because your knowledge is just that great. So thank you.
Yeah, happy to be here. Thanks for the chat, and we'll see everybody at the CEC on the 9th.
Yep.
Thank you, Ben.
Can find him. Oh, I'm going to plug him. Shut up, Sam. I'm doing plugs. you can find him on Twitter under the name Benjamin Burrows. I think it's at Rumblin Buff with no G. Is that right?
I believe it's at Rumblin Buffalo.
Okay, there you go. You also could hear him on Free Ball Podcast. They have a Patreon podcast where he came on to dissect the team over there. We love those guys, Tyler and Will. So before you jump into the CU basketball season, after another vacant CU football season in November, make sure you listen to them as well. And yeah, we're all getting excited and we're ready to watch a new era of CU basketball.
Yeah, and we're not going to talk about football on the pod. So thank you, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. See ya.
Buzz. 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 Buzz.